I was thinking about standing at the judgment seat, and then I was thinking, oh, I won't stand at the judgment seat, because if I really see my heart clearly, what I'll need to do is only bow.
Welcome to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of Mackenzie Study Center. Our hosts are Dr. Jack Crabtree and Christine Barber. Jack is a philosopher by training, but his real passion is the Bible, having studied and taught it for more than 25 years. He is currently on staff at Mackenzie Study Center and Gutenberg College in Eugene, Oregon. Christine is a licensed marriage and family therapist, having practiced in California and Oregon for over 20 years. She is employed by the Caris Foundation, a teaching and counseling ministry. In this series, titled Being a Christian, Jack and Christine discuss the most important biblical concepts of the Christian life. Now, here are Jack and Christine.
Jack, you know what is so cool? Is that years ago, you were my husband's teacher. How many years ago would that be?
Well,
I think 23, 25, yeah, something like that. And I met you back then, and I remember listening to you in one of his classes and thinking, this man is brilliant. How come he can understand stuff so well underneath and around it? And I was just really coveting the time with you at that time, and I have since then. In fact, my husband, Larry, I don't know if you remember, but he stayed for a third year in the school where you were teaching. It was a two-year program, just so that he could spend the time with you. Do you remember that?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We both have really appreciated where you've come from. And it's been very, very cool to be able to spend the last 2 years with you, 2.5, 3 hours a week, just recording this program and having the opportunity to hear you think and to appreciate the way you think and the things that you've thought about and the depth at which you've thought about them.
Thank you.
Well, that was kind of a compliment, a big compliment, but actually where I was going was it just to embarrass you. He's really embarrassed, I think. If his face would turn red, he probably would. Where I'm going is what I have learned about myself is that I'm smart, too. It has been a really exciting thing to be your peer. Mm-hmm. I used to think I really couldn't keep up with you. And we were joking before the program, who's the main exegete of this program? And we were saying it was me. And Tucker, the guy who records for us, said, yeah, Christine, sure, you're the exegete. But he was kidding. And that's not the area where I'm obviously strong. But in being able to keep up with you and think with you and ask you questions that make sense and are relevant, I feel very much your peer, and that's been a really great thing for me, and I appreciate the opportunity to have been here and had the opportunity to learn that.
Yeah, that's great. I'm convinced that there's fear gets in the way of a lot in our lives. When we feel intimidated by people, it's because we think that they have something going for them that we don't have, and you know, sometimes that's true. I mean, sometimes people are just a whole lot more brilliant than I am. But normally, it's just a matter of vocabulary, experience, time, mm-hmm. and I'm fully capable of doing what they're doing. But it's just not the way my life has gone. It's just not what I have concentrated on or focused on in my life. But there's so many rich things that we, especially when it comes to Bible study, so many believers could have a very rich experience of studying the Bible if they would just try it. But they're afraid that they won't be good enough or something, that they won't be adequate to the task, so they never even try. And I think that's really unfortunate because I'm convinced a lot of us are a whole lot more intelligent than we give ourselves credit for.
Yeah, and we've said in other programs that we think in different ways. Mm-hmm. And if we give ourselves the opportunity to think differently, because I do think differently than you, I think down different avenues, but my mind just doesn't go in the same direction yours does or come at it in the same way. But nonetheless, I have a mind that can really stay with things well if I take the time to stick with them.
Right.
And I work with people who are so... some people who are just so convinced that they're stupid, mm-hmm. and that makes me really sad for them. And I'm sure that there's people listening today who think, yeah, well, I am dumb. And I, you know, there's some people that aren't as gifted as others, but we do think in really different ways. I know a kid who thought he was dumb all throughout high school, and he recently took the SAT scores, and he got in the high 1300s, which is
wow.
a very high score.
Yeah.
And he was shocked. It really changed his high school last year career, because he finally thought, well, I am bright. And what people had been telling him all along was, you just think differently. We think that you've got a lot going for you, but it's, you're just not thinking along the same vein. And he was very encouraged to see that score and say, wow, it's different than what I thought.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's sometimes it takes something a more or less objective measure like that for us to believe what other people have told us, what we should believe about ourselves, because we're so afraid and we're so intimidated by the other people around us that are either articulate or precocious or their intellectual ability and their verbal ability has increased faster, and we feel like we've been kind of left behind, and we judge ourselves as just inadequate in that regard, and we don't recognize that it's really a fixable problem. I just need to give it some time and give it some attention, and I'll find out what native ability God has actually given me, and it's a lot more than I had ever dreamt.
Watch your grammar, Jack.
Yeah.
Anyway, thanks for the time with you. I've really, really found it rich, and really so glad that we have this program, because I think sharing what you have to give is of such vast a value.
Thank you.
We have been talking the last several weeks about spirituality.
Mm-hmm.
And actually today we were going to start by talking about Kierkegaard. And that's why I kind of started on this whole thing about feeling like I was intelligent, because I remember 20 years ago thinking I could never discuss Kierkegaard. He's a Danish philosopher, because I just wasn't smart enough. I remember a friend in school doing that. But we decided that we're going to talk about Kierkegaard maybe next time, maybe in a few programs from now, but it's a challenge that I'm excited that I could take up. But while I was listening to your tape on Kierkegaard that was done at the Spirituality Conference, the Oktoberfest, just a few months ago, and it was excellent. I thought about, what about the Beatitudes? Isn't that a real description of what true spirituality is?
Mm-hmm.
And I would like to go into that today.
Okay.
And just go through the Beatitudes, and I think we'll be looking at Matthew 5. Is that right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I'd like to act like a pastor and say, let's all turn to chapter 5 of Matthew. I never got to quite be a pastor, so there was my chance. You know, people might ask, why are we talking about spirituality? And we've done, I don't know, maybe 2 or 4 programs on spirituality, and to me, they've been really very valuable. And I think particularly the Beatitudes may be very helpful, because there's so many people who are absolutely tortured by the agonizing question of, am I a believer?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the Beatitudes really addresses this better than anything else.
Yeah, yeah, really, because that's Jesus' intention, is to define who is it that is really a child of God, one who is going to inherit the kingdom of God. Exactly.
So let's go.
Okay. Well, I suppose to understand, maybe we should read them into the record maybe here.
Sure.
Opening his mouth, he began to teach them, saying, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the," my translation has gentle, I prefer meek. "Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be satisfied. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God. Blessed are those who have been persecuted for the sake of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven."
So you're stopping there. Why?
Yeah, we wouldn't have to. Yeah. "Blessed are you when men revile you and persecute you and say all kinds of evil against you falsely on account of me. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward in heaven is great, for so they persecuted the prophets who were before you. you are the salt of the earth, but if the salt has become tasteless, how will it be made salty again? It is good for nothing anymore, except to be thrown out and trampled underfoot by men. You are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden, nor do men light a lamp and put it under the peck measure, but on the lampstand, and it gives light to all who are in the house. Let your light shine before men in such a way that they may see your good works and glorify your Father who is in heaven. I think the place to start in understanding these is with the term blessed. I think that's important because I remember as a child, and I don't know whether it's because this is the message being sent to me or just one of those quirky little weird ideas that kids get because they get the meaning of words wrong. I'm not sure. But when I first was taught the Beatitudes as a child, I thought blessed meant something like a really super spiritual saint. That blessed is something that apostles and Christ was and people who are particularly superstars in the realm of spirituality.
I always thought that blessed meant happy.
Or happy. Mm-hmm. That's a word that later then, that's what people taught me. Happy or fortunate. And that's a lot closer. I think that's... Happy is not so good, I don't think, but fortunate is a lot better. It means literally what it says. That is, blessed is somebody who has received a blessing from God, essentially, or stands to receive a blessing, perhaps. But the idea is a good thing, a really truly good thing is going to come to such as these.
Or is already bestowed on these people who have these things in their life.
Yeah, right? And that's a very actually interesting interpretive question here in the Beatitudes is which of those does he mean?
Oh, really?
Because he could mean either. And I suppose somehow he could mean both at the same time. But that I've wrestled with that and have never really been able to resolve that completely, what exactly he has in mind. Does he mean... Let's take the first one, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Does he mean, if you are among those who are poor in spirit, you are going to be blessed, and what you're going to be blessed with is the kingdom of heaven? That will be the blessing that you stand to inherit. Or is he saying, the fact that you are poor of spirit means that you have been blessed by God. God has given you this blessing of being poor in spirit. If we put these in the context of the rest of the New Testament teaches, both are true. I mean, both are blessings from God. So which exactly does Jesus have in mind, or does he somehow mean both? I can't decide that. I don't know. I mean, these are so succinct and so clever, really, that I think it's possible that he really means to capture both ideas at the same time. The other thing to notice, I think, is... Notice the first beatitude, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. And then the last one that's in this form, blessed are those who have been persecuted for the sake of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. The end part of the formula, why are they blessed, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven, is identical in the first one and in the last one. In between, he varies it. For they shall be comforted, for they shall inherit the earth, for they shall be satisfied, for they shall receive mercy. But all those various comments that he makes in between are sandwiched between, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven on both ends of the bookend. I think that's not insignificant because in the final analysis, I will argue that all of these are basically describing our citizenship in the kingdom of heaven one day. That why are the people who fit this description... Why are they blessed? Because they have been qualified to inherit the kingdom of heaven. And then when he starts varying it, he's just talking about different aspects of what that kingdom of heaven is all about and what it's like and what is in store for us there. So it's really just one thing that is the blessing of God, and he's just going to get at that in a lot of different ways here.
So it sounds to me, Jack, like the Beatitudes are talking about what we're going to get later,
mm-hmm.
not what we have now. And
exactly.
You were saying it could be both.
Well, not exactly. Well, let me comment on another aspect of these, and that maybe that'll make this clear. these Beatitudes are really ironic, because everything he's going to point to here are things that, from a worldly perspective, you would look at it and say, boy, that's too bad, to be poor in spirit. And our normal human response to someone who, we haven't defined what poor in spirit is, but someone who is poor rather than wealthy and rich, somebody who's mourning rather than filled with joy and happiness and delight, someone who meekly believes that all the grief that's happening to them is deserved, the one who is hungry and thirsty for righteousness because they don't have it. I mean, all of these are deficits of one kind or another. All of these are being deprived of something that looks really good, and Jesus is coming along and saying, boy, aren't you lucky? Boy, aren't you in a good position? Aren't you fortunate? Aren't you someone who's going to be blessed by God because, or either are going to be blessed by God or has been blessed by God because you're experiencing all this deprivation? It's really ironic. It's terribly ironic. And that's part of the point of them, is Jesus is intentionally trying to be ironic in the face of the teaching of the Pharisees of his day, where they think that the blessing of God is manifest by the prosperity and the wealth and the success and the power of a person. Jesus is coming along and saying, no, the people who are really fortunate because they are blessed by God are the weak and the failing and the unsuccessful. Those are the people who are really fortunate. So there's this incredible irony here. The issue I was getting at earlier as to which is the blessing is the blessing the kingdom of God to come, or is the blessing the fact that I have been qualified by God for the kingdom of God to come by weakness and failure and deprivation and so on? And as I say, ultimately it's very clear that the failure and the deprivation wouldn't even be a blessing if it didn't amount to a qualification that I would be in the kingdom of heaven one day. So ultimately, clearly, the blessing that he has in mind is the kingdom of heaven, that the book ends on each end of these Beatitudes. That's clearly the ultimate blessing. But I can't help but think part of what he's saying is, as a part of the irony, is, but you have to understand that you wouldn't be meek if God had not blessed you with meekness. You wouldn't be poor if God had not blessed you with poverty. You wouldn't be hungry for righteousness if God had not planted that hunger in your heart. You wouldn't be weeping if God had not blessed you with grief. And it's a very ironic thing to say, but as we will see as we go through here, that makes a lot of sense. It's unfortunate, but most of us don't grieve over what we should grieve over. It takes a miraculous intervention from God to teach us to grieve as we should.
Yeah. Well, let's get into them.
Okay. So the first one, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Luke just says, blessed are the poor. He doesn't really add the in spirit in his rendition of the Beatitudes.
Can I just stop us for a minute?
Sure.
I just am, as I think about going into these, Jack, I'm just really excited. Excited in kind of this quiet way, like I have this heaviness in my chest that's kind of anticipating something that's weighty and difficult, and yet is going to speak right to the core of what I believe in and what I live my life for and what's important to me.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you're going to talk the language of God here. And does that make sense to you?
Oh, yeah.
And I just think, oh boy,
yeah.
Here we go. I'm so blessed to have the opportunity to speak in this language. It's like walking outside of the doors of the earth and walking into kind of this other realm and being able to sit here for a few minutes and take it in and just be nourished. Like I get a break from the hassle and questions of everyday life, like the bills I have to pay and the kids I have to get to school and the clothes I've got to iron, and kind of go down to, yes, this is what life is really about.
Yeah, exactly.
Is that how you experience the Beatitudes?
Absolutely. And the Beatitudes were there were two revolutions in my life. One was in the study of the Book of Romans, and that was a partial revolution. The other one happened when I sat down to teach, to study, to teach the Beatitudes 10 to 12 years ago. And it totally revolutionized my life, because I expected to find one thing, and what I found instead was a radically different conception of what it meant to be a believer, and I didn't use this language at the time, but what true spirituality was. And I've never seen the Bible the same since. I mean, it just opened it up to me in a way that that I was blind to before. And it is. It's Jesus himself directly addressing the question that is the most important question of our lives, and that is, what are the marks that I belong to God? What are the marks that I have a hope and a future? What does it take to know that about myself? And this is a direct answer to that question. So I don't know that you can get any more important teaching in the Bible than this.
It doesn't get better.
No.
Okay. I had to just stop because I was just
bubbling over there.
Kind of bubbling in a very kind of heavy way.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Kind of a sober
yeah.
bubbling. All right.
So, blessed are the poor, or blessed are the poor in spirit. We really distort this terribly, both Christians and non-Christians, especially non-Christians. I'm thinking of Paul Simon, of Simon and Garfunkel fame. He wrote a song that kind of plays with the Beatitudes a little bit. And there, he understands Jesus to be saying, you know, those of you who are beat up and failing and are the downtrodden and the oppressed of the earth, you're really the good guys. You know, you're really the people who are people of virtue. And there's a tendency in a certain manner of thinking in modern society that just see victims of various kinds as somehow virtuous by virtue of their victimhood. So the third world people are virtuous people. I mean, they're unlike us wealthy Westerners who are evil people. The downtrodden, oppressed people of the world are really virtuous, salt of the earth kind of people, and we really should be more like them. Well, that's not what Jesus is saying. Jesus is not saying, if you've been dealt the lot in life that you happen to be poor and downtrodden and oppressed rather than successful, wealthy, and prosperous, then you're really the people who God is going to shine his light on in the end and bless. It's not that simple. There are a lot of people who live in poverty who are greedy, who are selfish, who are evil materialists. And there are wealthy people who are, as Jesus describes here, poor in spirit. What he's talking about is a kind of personal impoverishment.
There's this emphasis on the spirit.
Right. Yeah, and that's
what's internal.
That's I think why Matthew adds that phrase to make it clear. This is my self-concept that he's talking about primarily, and that's what I think Matthew means by in spirit. As I look at my life and all that it entails, do I look at it and I raise my face to God and say, God, all is well. You've done a good job on me. I'm what a wonderful creature I am, and what a wonderful life I have. Or do I look at the realities of my life and I go, this is empty. This is not what I was made for. This is not what I want. This is not fulfillment to me. This is empty. So a very wealthy person, for example, who has anything that money could buy and has been successful, I mean, the money is not only a tool to get whatever I want, but it's a symbol of my success, it's a symbol of my status, it's a symbol of my power, it's a symbol that I'm, in my own mind, that I'm a really wonderful human being, as human beings go, but who has the eyes to see how hollow and empty his existence is, that person would qualify in terms of what Jesus is saying here. That person is poor in spirit. Because he hasn't deceived himself into thinking that all that I have acquired and all that I've accomplished in this life amounts to anything. He recognizes that it doesn't amount to anything because he's been enlightened enough by God to recognize that the only thing that's really valuable is wisdom and integrity and goodness, godliness, righteousness. Those are the things that have substance to them, and those are the very things that I'm lacking in. Those are the very things that I am inadequate in. I fall way short of the moral perfection and the integrity and the goodness and the godliness that would really make me a substantive person and would really fill up my existence and my life. And because I lack those things, I lack everything that's important. And so as I look at my life and ask myself the question, am I full or am I empty? Am I rich or am I poor? My judgment on my own existence has to be I'm poor. I really don't have the wealth that counts.
What we're talking about is a person who has been humbled. And
yes.
I think I would put an emphasis on that word, humbled. Brought to our knees by a recognition of the condition of our hearts.
Right.
And when I see my heart, it's not a pretty picture. I can really work at being kind towards you, but I have a lot of unkindness in my heart, and that is what humbles me. It doesn't make me think I'm less than or unacceptable to God because of that. No, I'm not less than other people. We're all in need of the same humility because we all have the same hearts. Am I less loved by God for it? No. It was his recognition of the condition of my heart that brought the cross.
Right.
And that necessitated the cross.
Now, what you're describing is how someone who's poor in spirit would evaluate and would respond to it. We don't all do that. Many of us look at the trappings of our lives and pat ourselves on the back in our self-deception and say, I'm really pretty good. I'm really a pretty important person. I'm really pretty substantial.
Well, you know, can I interrupt?
Yeah,
for
go
me?
Ahead.
You know, I was talking to somebody who's important to me recently. This friend is very wealthy and has been very successful in their life in terms of their financial gain, in terms of a lot that the world would value, but also this person tends to be a very responsible, productive, giving, serving person that really wants to have and does work toward integrity with a lot of earnestness. And I was talking to this person, and they said, you know, they had a heart attack, and they said, you know, I was on the gurney going into the emergency room, and I realized that maybe I would not come out. And I wondered, is it okay that I die now? And they said, yeah, I decided it was okay because I want to get it right for this person. He said, I look around and I see what I've gotten relative to other people, and I have really been rich in this life. And he is meaning not just the financial wealth, though that's important because he's been able to get things that are valuable to him and that lots of people would consider valuable, even those who are truly poor in spirit. But there's an ingredient that's missing that understands with humility what his heart looks like. So this thing can be very deceptive because he said, I'm thankful to God for this. And yet, I don't know if he's got this bigger picture, not just thankful that God's blessed me with a lot of stuff, but that God has, at this very point, blessed me. Are you with me?
Right. Right. Remember in the parable of the Pharisee and the sinner at the temple, the Pharisee says, God, I thank you that I am not like other men, and then goes on to trot out his credentials about all the good things, all the righteous things he does. His gratitude was toward God. I mean, you can't fault him for that. But the problem is his complete self-deception and his self-delusion. I mean, anyone that can say, I am not like other men, does not understand himself and does not see himself. And that's kind of at the heart of self-delusion, something that I am all too familiar with in my life, is that attitude that, you know, I really think I'm made of different stuff. I must be an intrinsically better person than the rest of humanity because look how good I am. Look how well I'm able to live my life, how godly I'm able to be. And one of the most wonderful gifts God ever gave me was to rub my nose in my own moral inadequacy.
How did you do that, Jack?
Just through opening my eyes to the areas in which those things that my whole perception was closed off to, that I couldn't see my pride, my contempt for other people, my hatred of other people, my a lack of self-control, a lack of principle, where I prided myself in being so principled, could find myself at a moment of convenience acting against principle at the drop of a hat. It just shocked me, you know. This person who's such a principled person and who could act so unprincipled, I can't even say it.
Unprincipled.
Yeah. And I'll, you know, just bit by bit chipped away at my self-righteousness until I came to realize the truth about me is I am just like other people. To the point now where I really believe of myself, given the right situations, I would be as capable of doing anything anyone has ever done. I'm probably more civilized. I mean, realistically, I've had a great childhood, upbringing, circumstances. I'm probably more civilized, but that's not my heart. You know, that's given the condition of my heart. Put me in the right situation under the right pressures, what is there that I couldn't be capable of doing? And I think that's really fundamentally true about me. That's a gift, though. It's so easy.
To know that is a gift.
To know that is a gift about yourself. To know that about yourself is a gift from God, because it is so easy to be self-deluded and to think of yourself that, no, I'm better. I'm made of different stuff. There are just places that I wouldn't go. There are things that I would just never do. And I can look with horror and contempt at the people who are so weak and so morally inadequate that they engage in those lifestyles or those practices or do those things. And so easy to believe that I would never be capable of doing that.
I remember saying those words so much in my life. I would never do that.
Mm-hmm.
And I might find myself saying those words sometimes, though I don't think I have in a long time. But I don't believe it.
And you probably
I could do it.
And I think sometimes I can still think that. Then I meant I really am not
capable,
inherently capable of it. Now I mean my value system is such, I really believe in a value system that I don't want that anymore. I really don't want that. And that's different. I mean, that is part of what it means to be sanctified. But in terms of being capable of doing it, I think I've been persuaded that I'm capable.
Yeah, I've been very persuaded of that also in my own life. And you said that it was a gift. It's a blessing.
Exactly.
And the reason that it's a gift or a blessing is because naturally we don't see it that way. I'm thinking of the person that I was talking about earlier who kind of took stock of their own life on the gurney. And I wonder, and I really don't know, I wonder if that person would say, I've taken stock of my life and I am better. I have been more blessed. I've kind of been this gold person, this golden person. I was talking recently to a woman who said, you know, I always thought I was the fine china. And as I've been going through counseling with you know what I found out? I found I'm the broken clay chart.
Yeah. Yeah.
And though she says, that's really hard for me to know that, and yet it's a relief for me to be able to sit with the reality of what's true about me. It's such a paradox, Jack. Lots of people in listening to us could think, oh, okay, what am I supposed to do? Cry all the time? Feel bad all the time? And is that what we're advocating? Can you make a distinction for us between just feeling bad all the time and thinking we're the dredge of the earth as poor in spirit, or having this gift of humility?
Well, yeah, it's a very important distinction to be made, and that is what Jesus is talking about here is a deep, profound understanding of myself. And at the level of my deepest understanding, should my life be constantly one of grief? Yes. Of mourning? And yes. And of impoverishment? Yes. But at the more surface level of the emotional landscape of my life, can we be happy? Can we laugh? Can we enjoy the good gifts of life? Sure, sure. He's not talking about having a morose personality, a morose temperament, or a morose emotional experience constantly. He's talking about self-understanding. What is your real, deep-down, true value system, and how does your experience and your life and your person measure up relative to that? And in that regard, we better be chagrined constantly. We better be able to recognize the inadequacy of what my life is now, because that's the way God created it. He didn't intend for my fulfillment to come now. This is the school, the classroom, the training ground to prepare me for the time of my fulfillment.
And you wouldn't argue that there are some fulfilling times.
Oh, absolutely.
Wife gives you a surprise birthday party and all your friends are there from the last 30 years and you're just filled with joy and comfort and it is a good evening.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of joy isn't what we're denying here. What we're talking about is this recognition of who we are at the core of our being, which is sobering to us, humbling to us, and ultimately brings us a great deal of stability.
Mm-hmm.
It is the core of emotional stability.
Yes.
Of psychological stability, of spiritual stability. All of those are intermixed. They are what gives us a ground to walk on. However, when we first come to break through this denial, this recognition that we are poor in spirit, we go from, like you were talking about, God has over time taken you away from being the self-righteous, maybe pompous, maybe arrogant person that you were, and I was,
mm-hmm.
and am too many times still, but brought you to kind of uncover your eyes, kind of take the scales off your eyes to see.
Mm-hmm.
During those times, Jack, they can be very sad.
Devastating.
Devastating. It isn't that I'm going to feel happy at those times in my life. And if there's a lot that I need to see, it could be that there are months and months of being almost hit by train after train of the reality of myself and who I am as the scales are taken off my eyes and I see. Does that make sense to
yes,
you?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, one of the Beatitudes is, blessed are those who mourn. And that's exactly what he's talking about. I mean, that's the very next one. That's exactly what he's talking about, is that grieving that is a very appropriate response to seeing and acknowledging and being confronted with my brokenness, my moral unworthiness. That if we don't go there, if that's not at any part of our experience whatsoever, then we don't have this blessing that we're not children of God destined for the kingdom of heaven. So that's an essential part.
It just follows that if I am poor in spirit, I am going to mourn.
Yes.
At the core of my being. And sometimes it will be more obvious, and I will kind of be taken up in that. And other times I'll just know it underneath. It's like this thing that I know. Like when we started talking about the Beatitudes, remember I said it was, you said you're bubbling, and I said, well, but it's a...
Sober bubbling.
Sober
serious
bubbling.
Yeah.
Serious bubbling. And that's what, I'm not sad all the time, but when I touch into this reality, there's this soberness that I recognize in myself.
Mm-hmm.
Even though on the surface of my life, I have quite a lot of good things and lots of joy and good relationships and things that are delightful to me.
Yeah.
This is better, though. This is richer.
Right. Notice how often Paul gives the exhortation in his letters, Paul and Peter and all the apostles, be sober. You know, be sober. It's so easy for us to be kind of silly and superficial. And one of the keys is that I allow the soberness of the truth about myself to really land, to really take root and come home to me. Let me talk about the example you gave, because maybe this will be helpful. You mentioned my wife giving me a birthday party, friends for 30 years around. I mean, a really rich experience. Some people, the person who doesn't have the eyes to see, the person who's not poor in spirit, is the person who lives for those experiences. He seeks to recreate those experiences over and over and over again in his life, because that's what life is to him. And if he has the resources, and if all goes well, if he's lucky, if you will, he can create a lot of those experiences for himself, and can say of his life, my life has been rich. But there's a person who's silly, because there's a person who doesn't realize how ephemeral the joy of those things is, how it doesn't last, how it cannot sustain itself, because there's ultimately no real deep-rooted substance to it. There's true self-satisfaction is something that I can always take with me. It doesn't depend on an occasion. It doesn't depend on circumstances. It doesn't depend on the right things happening the right way in my life. It's the self-satisfaction that comes from within, because it's the self-satisfaction of knowing that I have integrity, knowing that I have substance as a person, knowing that I'm good, that I'm right with God, that I'm what I should be, and so on. That's the kind of self-satisfaction that we'll have in the kingdom of God, I think, where all has been made new, I have been rewired, and I am no longer broken. I am an utterly and completely whole being, whole human being. It won't matter what's happening around me in my environment, because I am right, because I am whole, because I am substantive. I think that's what Jesus was getting at. I think. It's a difficult passage, but I think that's what Jesus was getting at when he was talking to the woman at the well in Samaria. And he says, I know water that you know not of. And he talks about there being springs of living water welling up from within. I think it's something like that he had in mind. A self-satisfaction, a fulfillment, a refreshment that comes from within, and that is not dependent upon my environment or the occasions that I'm in. So a child of God who is poor in spirit can truly enjoy that birthday party, can truly find it a rich and rewarding experience, but he lets it be just what it is and doesn't try to milk it for more than it is. He doesn't try to make it the end-all and be-all and substance of his existence. He just lets it be a little serendipitous joy that happened, and it's really neat that it happened. But at the same time, he recognizes, but my life right now is not full yet, because I'm not full, because I'm not what I need to be. That's someone who's poor in spirit, I think. That's what he's talking about.
So, Jack, something that you said could be confusing to people. It's possible that I just missed it, but let's go back just in case. You were saying this person with the birthday party wouldn't feel satisfied with it ultimately. It wouldn't be the meaning of his life. He wouldn't live for this because he recognized that there was something that he was going to inherit in eternal life that was full and rich and good.
Right.
And that's what he's looking for. Not that he can look at his life now and say, I'm all good, I'm all rich, it's all fine.
Right, exactly. I mean, as you point out, there is a kind of balance, a kind of emotional and spiritual health, a kind of wholeness that comes from just being the wise, enlightened person that the Beatitudes are talking about.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not that it doesn't have any substantial effect.
Very substantial.
It's very substantial. But that emotional health comes from recognizing that I am fundamentally broken right now. And I've learned to be okay with the fact that I'm broken, because I realize that that's not going to make me forfeit everything that my heart ultimately longs for. And in fact, it qualifies me for what my heart ultimately longs for. But I'm still looking forward to being fulfilled. I'm not really experiencing true fulfillment right now. Not in the ultimate sense. There's a kind of emptiness that will always be a part of my experience now, because this life just isn't fulfilling. There are too many things that are wrong with it.
it's not fulfilling if I'm willing to really look at things that are deeper than the temporal joys here. Even a good thing like having that birthday party with 30 years of great friends.
Right, right.
Now, we've got about 5 minutes left, and I want to go in this particular direction. We have a lot more to say here. We didn't get through the Beatitudes.
No, we didn't.
Not even close. Surprise.
Yeah.
You said that Jesus talks about being sober. All the apostles talk about being sober. What if I am not sobered by this sense of being poor in spirit or mourning? What if I don't have this deep inner sense that you and I are talking about? It could be very discouraging to people. They could think, oh my heavens, maybe I'm not a believer, or how do I get this experience so I know I'm a believer? Do you follow me, Jack?
Yeah. Well, I, on the one hand, that should be sobering. I mean, there is an element of it. We, in our Christian culture, there's a tendency I see among us to want to really try to fix people's insecurity with regard to where they stand spiritually. We want to reassure them. We want to tell them everything's okay. Oh, sure, you're a child of God. That's not the position that the Bible takes. The Bible really leaves that question out there as a serious question to be faced into. It doesn't offer quick and easy comfort and reaffirmation. So if we're going to follow the pattern and the model of Jesus and the apostles, then we have to say, well, frankly, that is a possibility. If you really, truly are not sobered by this, then maybe you're not blessed, like the Beatitudes are, like the people that the Beatitudes are describing. Maybe you're without that blessing. Maybe you're not a child of God. Maybe you're not going to inherit the kingdom of God. Now, having said that, we have to recognize that there's a kind of false insecurity that is very easy to experience, and that is, it comes from not really understanding what he's saying here, of thinking that I have to have this deep emotional response in order for me to qualify as poor in spirit. And it's very important that we recognize that's really not the right criteria. We can't measure whether I'm poor in spirit by the depth of my emotional response. This is as I said before, this is at the level of self-understanding. It's intellectual, but it's even really beyond intellectual. It's existential. That is, it's how I evaluate my own life right now. What is my real, true evaluation of it? And that ultimately needs to be measured by the criteria of the choices I make in life, not how I feel about my life. In fact, usually when the apostles talk about be sober, what they really mean is make choices that are in touch with the reality of your situation. Don't be foolish and frivolous in the choices that you make in life. So I wouldn't measure how I stack up here by how I feel about myself, but it's how I perceive myself as that translates into the choices I make in life.
That's a big issue, Jack.
Yeah, it is.
And I think I brought it up right at the end without us being able to go into it enough. So what if we do this? What if we say, that's a great answer, but probably when people hear it, they'll not necessarily be able to get their arms around it,
right?
Because it's such a big concept. So for you people who are thinking, what do you mean? Wait a minute, how come I'm not getting this? It's because it is so big. So let's try and address it again, perhaps even in our next program.
Okay.
So, you're thinking of sending your kid to college, or you want to attend yourself? Before making your decision, be sure to ask this question. What is college for? For some, college is the rite of passage from youth to adulthood. For others, it's a stepping stone to a good job. Gutenberg College believes education should be a doorway to a good life. Then you might wisely ask, what is a good life? The Gutenberg College faculty and staff are committed to the conviction that living the good life is rooted in wisdom and character. Admittedly, Gutenberg is not for everyone. But if you are interested in reading and discussing the greatest thinkers, philosophers, poets, and theologians of Western civilization, if you are interested in working personally with your teachers, if you want to open the doorway to a good life, There is not a better education opportunity offered in the Northwest than Gutenberg College. Most members of the Gutenberg faculty also teach at McKenzie Study Center. McKenzie was founded on the belief that a clear understanding of God's Word is more than an intellectual exercise, that the Bible has a radical message for every human being. At McKenzie, you can find classes, seminars, conferences, counseling, tapes, and articles, all focused toward knowing and applying God's Word to our everyday experiences. At the conclusion of today's program, I'll tell you how you can contact McKenzie Study Center and Gutenberg College. But now, let's get back to Jack Crabtree and Christine Barber.
For some time at the end of the program now, we have asked listeners for financial support. And we've asked listeners for financial support, not just give us money, but if this program has been a benefit to you, please consider supporting it. So again today, I would like to share a letter from somebody, it's actually quite lengthy, that talks about their interest and their involvement in this program. It's people like this that we'd like to ask to support our program. Dear Jack and Christine, I'd like to respond to the statement Jack often makes about there being two kinds of people in this world, drug addicts and philosophers. I think there's a third kind of person, someone addicted to philosophy. At least I feel I'm addicted to your tapes. I seem to crave them, to crave truth and reality, which I believe is overflowing from your series. I can't wait to listen to the Christianity at Work tapes. I can't get the radio station clearly. When I do get them, I gobble them up within days while driving in my car. Then the most awful thing happens. They conclude and I have to wait for the next batch to arrive. Currently, the past 2 years, I've been struggling to make sense of certain physical limitations God has brought my way. Your program has greatly helped me focus on what's important. Especially memorable is the tape entitled Trials and Suffering. I've listened to it at least 6 times. I've appreciated how Jack allowed us to know intimate details about his life and how Christine in earlier tapes revealed her struggles with cancer. It's reassuring, as obvious as it might seem to some, to know that everyone suffers in this life and that God is ultimately the author of that suffering. I spent a lot of months after being diagnosed with a chronic illness asking all those what-if questions, as if I could control my destiny. 2 lines from the tape spoken by Christine continue to resonate. Life sometimes hits you like a rear-end collision, and I didn't know life was going to be so hard. Your series often feels like it was put into existence just for me. That's how profoundly I've been impacted by your work. I appreciate the dynamic conversation that exists between both of you. I feel your sharing impacts the two of you as much as your audience. Yes, it does. As well, I've enjoyed the playful banter and humor that has become more frequent as the series has unfolded and the way you allow yourselves to be stretched by one another. Despite your different fields of expertise and approaches, your respect for each other and for the truth of the gospel is clear. The synergy that results between the two of you is remarkable. Either of you alone wouldn't be as effective as I think the two of you are together. I could go on, but mostly I want to encourage you and let you know how much you have encouraged me to hold fast as I continue my journey toward the kingdom. Well, listener, that's really a wow letter. Thank you for so clearly and energetically telling us about what you've learned, about how important this program has been to you. It really warms our hearts.
You have been listening to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of McKenzie Study Center. If you would like a free copy of this program, would like to order other programs, or want to know more about McKenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College, please call us at 541-485-4801. Again, that's area code 541-485-4801. You can write us at 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. And you may also find us on the net at www.mckenziestudycenter.org. Tapes can be purchased with check or Visa card. If you desire to support the ministry of McKenzie Study Center, your gift will be entirely tax deductible. Please mail your check to McKenzie Study Center. Again, 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. The telephone number again, 541-485-4801. Now, on behalf of Dr. Jack Crabtree, Christine Barber, and the other staff of McKenzie Study Center, thank you for listening.